Podcast. This is monumental milestone episode 25.
Silver anniversary.
That's right. What did you get me?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Same thing you got me. How about that?
25 episodes of great poker companionship.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe 24. I skipped down on one episode.
Well, we've given our listeners like 50 hours of good content or something like that.
Great content.
Yeah, great content.
There are two more hours of it coming up today.
Yeah, we have Ed Miller today. We have a lot of Ed Miller today.
Yeah, it's hard to get enough of Ed Miller. Had you met him in person before?
No, I hadn't.
I kind of only knew him from his web presence and reading his books, but I felt like we had a good chemistry pretty much from the beginning, the three of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was expecting to like him. I ended up liking him a lot more than I even thought I would.
Bit of a man crush.
Yeah. I think we also have somewhat more in common than I expected to. Like, I had some indistinct idea that this was somebody with a worldview rather different from mine. And yeah, that was part of why I was looking forward to talking to him. And it turned out that actually our backgrounds are more similar than I knew, and some of our habits are more similar also. So
yeah, he's very down to earth, and I think he also has a skill that's pretty unique among poker players and poker writers, which is an ability to talk at a bunch of different levels. And I think you can see that both in the books that he's written and then also in when he's responding to questions. You know, we had, I think from the questions that we had submitted by readers for Ed, or by listeners for Ed, it was clear that the questions were coming from a variety of skill levels. Like, some people were asking questions that I think indicated they were more beginning players, and other people were asking pretty sophisticated questions. And I thought Ed did a good job of picking up what that particular person was looking for in their question and answering with an appropriate level of sophistication. Like, I felt like he stepped up his game a bit to talk. Well, I don't mean he stepped up his game exactly, but compared to the average skill level and average level of complexity he seemed to be writing for in his book, I felt like when it was just the three of us talking poker strategy, he was able to step it up and talk at a higher level pretty seamlessly. And I think a lot of people are just, they're at the level that they're at, and it's not really possible. Like, for extremely good players or players who understand things at a really high level, it's not always possible for them to, I don't want to say dumb it down, but just, you know, talk to someone who doesn't already know a lot of the things that they know. They're really only capable of talking on the cutting edge. And if you need to have a concept like equity explained to you, that person is just going to be like, I don't know how to talk to you.
Yeah, I imagine he would be a very good coach.
Yeah, I think so.
So because we did so much strategy with Ed, we are not going to have a separate strategy segment. It's just going to be all Ed this week. So
yeah, but the quote book club is pretty much just an hour of pure strategy with Ed Miller. There's some talk about what's in the book, and even that is, of course, heavily strategy driven. But we get pretty far afield, I think, from the content of the book, or step pretty well beyond it. I suppose we're still talking about the same topics, but I think there's a lot of content in this interview that goes above and beyond what's in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a whole episode, but with somewhat less of me and more of Ed. So really, the listeners win here. So Ed was great, and we had a really good talk with him.
Yeah, and so more book club news. We do have a book and a book club guest confirmed for next month, and I encourage you all to start reading Tommy Angelo's Elements of Poker. And that's right, we will have a return of Tommy Angelo to the podcast. He'll be coming on the last week of April to discuss his book, and so we'll be reading the book over the course of the first 3 weeks of April. For those who haven't read it, Elements of Poker is a book that's quite different from Ed Miller's book. This is going to be a real 180-degree turn, I think. I mean, they're both great writers, but they're writing in very different ways and for very different purposes. And I think Elements of Poker is really quite different from any other book that's out there. It addresses important concepts that don't come up in other books, that other books don't even try to get at. Although, I mean, and it was really the first. There's been a few other books that are a little more focused on the mental game now as well. Although that even Tommy comes at that from a slightly different angle than, say, Jared Tendler does. But, I mean, at the time this book was written, I mean, there was really nothing like it out there, either in terms of its content or especially the way that it's written. I mean, it's really almost poetic at times. I think Tommy is just much more accomplished in the craft of writing than most people who are writing poker books. This is one of my favorite poker books.
Yeah, and it's the sort of poker book I like to read for a lot of reasons, some of which are just short-term financial reasons. It's the sort of book that I read and it makes me better immediately. And the next session I play, I have a higher expectation than I would if I hadn't read Elements of Poker recently. It's that kind of book, you know? And of course,
fun. I enjoy reading it. It doesn't feel like work in the same way that even other poker books that I like, it still kind of feels like work to read them.
Yeah. If you don't read the book, you'll still get something out of the book club. If you don't want to listen to the book club, we'll still have other stuff in the podcast. So hopefully there should be something for everybody in April.
Yeah. So pick up a copy of Elements of Poker. I encourage you to get it from Tommy Angelo's website, which is just tommyangelo.com, TommyAngelo.com. So it's available either paperback or as an ebook, downloadable as an ebook. If you buy the paperback version from Tommy, he'll also write an inscription in it for free. So if you buy it through his website, you can just send him an email and say, hey, I just bought this book. And don't you tell him as much or as little as you want, and he'll write a personalized inscription in your book and send it to you, which is a pretty cool thing. So even if you already have Elements of Poker, if you didn't buy it from Tommy and you want to get that personalized inscription and autograph, I would encourage you to do that as well. I like having a number of autographed poker books, including one from Barry Greenstein, if you know what I'm saying.
Heyo. Well, what tournament was it?
It was the main event.
Excellent.
Yeah, 2007, I think, the second year that I played it.
Man, I need to go back and reread your trip reports if I can't remember that. So
it was actually kind of ridiculous that I mean, I had aces versus queens against him, and I almost didn't get a stack, which would have been, like, I really did not play the hand well. It was kind of embarrassing. It's sort of silly that he was even close to getting, that I made it possible for him to be even close to getting away from it. I pretty much just straight up cored him. It's not really a brag, but it's a fun trophy. So go pick up your copy of Elements of Poker, TommyAngelo.com, if you don't have one already, or if you do have one already and you want an autographed copy. And next week we will be discussing part one of the book, which is entitled Universal Elements, and that goes up to page 84, I believe. So we'll be reading through page 84 for part one and discussing that on next week's episode. As we mentioned, we don't have a separate strategy segment this week, but we still do want to show our appreciation to Tournament Poker Edge for sponsoring. A bunch of hand history reviews are going up on TP right now, a lot of stuff that you might be interested in. I mentioned a couple episodes back that they've got Casey Big Dog Pocket Fives Jarzebeck making videos over on Tournament Poker Edge. And you may have heard that he recently final tabled the Sunday Million back-to-back, which is a pretty impressive accomplishment. So he's just starting through a review of hand histories from, he's going to be doing both tournaments. So he's going to be running through both tournaments. If you're interested in final tabling the Sunday Million and what MTT player isn't, you can see from a guy who clearly knows how to do that. So he's going to be running through hand histories of that. You've got Mini F-Top's hand history review coming from Daryl Jace, maybe better known as like 7 or 8 A's, just A. So one of my favorite current posters on 2+2.
Yeah, he's smart. I always liked his stuff. I remember assuming that he was probably silly given what his screen name was. But then he started posting, and I came to realize he was really smart.
Yeah, but no, he definitely knows what he's talking about when it comes to poker. He spends a lot of time thinking about poker. It's very clear if you watch any of his videos or read his posts or anything.
Yeah.
So you got a Mini F-Tops hand history review from him coming up. Danny N13, who won the PokerStars Canada Cup, which is sort of a weird blend of live and online tournament. They play it online, and then they play the final table in person at the PCA. So the winner of that is doing a hand history review. And coming attraction in the next couple of weeks, there's going to be a hand history review from me coming up on there. My first two series for TPE were both kind of theory-driven slideshows and that sort of thing. And the next one is going to be a full-on hand history review, just me talking about every hand that I played in a WCUP tournament. So lots of good hand history content showing up on Tournament Poker Edge. And if you're not already a member, you can sign up, tournamentpokeredge.com. Thanks to them for the sponsorship. I'm doing excellent. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Yeah, we both very much appreciate your being here with us.
Cool. Well, thank you for doing a whole big book club and everything. That's
it's been pretty intense. It's been pretty popular, I think. Well, do you want to start off? Just what's your earliest poker memory?
It was online. I was working for Microsoft. I was sitting in my lonely apartment in the across the street from the Microsoft campus, and there was a big flashing banner ad that said, you know, you could deposit $100, and it was for Ultimate Bet, I remember, and this was probably 2001, and I don't know, it seemed like a good idea to me. I'd always been interested in gambling games, and I would say more so the idea of playing games and making money at it, so I was like, hey, maybe poker. So that's pretty much it. That's how I got hooked.
What kind of gambling did you do before poker?
Well, none really. I just kind of turned 21, and I never really gambled, you know, in college. I would have, except I just didn't know other people who gambled, I guess.
What were the gambling games that you were interested in?
Well, blackjack. I mean, I'd read a bunch of the blackjack books, and, you know, just, you know, I read a little bit about sports betting, and just the idea in general that, you know, you could get an edge on bets, a consistent edge, and you know, grind at it over and over and over and over again.
Do you take advantage of being in Las Vegas in order to make advantage plays that are not poker?
I did kind of when I first moved here, I did more of that. I did, I remember there was a video poker one that I did. Casino had set up a promotion where the machines were about 103.5% returns.
Wow.
And so I played that until they stopped.
Before or after comps?
So, it was before. It was just off the top. The machine. Wow. They added a new pay to the machine, so it was like the normal machine, and the normal machine paid back 100.17%. And then on top of that, they added a brand new pay where if you got four cards to a royal flush, but then the fifth was just bricked off, that was a pay that paid like 25 for 1, which wow. Which makes the game like ridiculous.
See, I would think that would attract sort of every grizzled, smelly advantage player in Las Vegas
within five minutes. The place was normally empty. I heard a rumor that they were trying to sell it, and so they sort of did this on purpose because, like, the day that they gave the tour, like, the floor was completely covered in people like banging on video poker machines. But yeah, and I remember the promotion was supposed to go on for a certain period of time. And I kept coming back day after day, and they would like shade it down a little bit each day, like, oh, now not this machine, now not, you know. But and then I remember one day I showed up and the parking lot was empty, and I was like, must be over. That's it. So yeah, so I did a little of that stuff just here and there, and less so now.
So you see an ad for Ultimate Bet, you've never played poker before, did you just deposit money and start playing?
That's exactly what I did. I put, I don't know, a couple hundred bucks online.
You just started right in with a couple hundred. You must be making good money at Microsoft.
Yeah, you know, I was 21, right? I was straight out of college, and I don't know, they were paying me. I mean, I was living on $18,000 a year in college, and then, I don't know, it was like $80,000 at Microsoft. So to me, this was just funny.
You thought you had $62,000 of disposable income.
Right, exactly. This was just, you know, money that was, you know, I... Campbell's soup only costs so much, right?
So, how did that go?
Not well. Not at first. No, it became clear to me that it was not going well very early on. So that's, I actually very, very early started kind of getting into books and 2+2. I don't remember how I found 2+2, but I found it very shortly thereafter, and I started posting, would have been 2001, and I found the Sklansky and Malmuth books and read 3 or 4 of those and said, oh, now I think I get it. And then I played for 6 more months and lost for 6 more months. and then one day, I don't know, one day it was like, it just finally clicked. And I was like, ah, I finally get it.
What game were you playing at the time?
It was Limit Hold'em. I started playing online, like 1-2 Limit Hold'em. And I guess that would have been about right. I mean, I don't remember exactly what I was playing, but I'm not sure I fully understood what I was playing either. And then I remember there was a moment where I realized that live poker was legal in the state of Washington, which was like a huge moment for me. and I said, wow, I can actually just go somewhere and play with actual chips against real people. And so I started doing that, and I played 4-8, and I played 4-8 again for about 6 months, Limit Hold'em. And I was like, man, these people are really unbelievably terrible. And, you know, they're not playing like in the book at all. But somehow I still managed to lose month over month for about the first 6 months. And I sort of, by month 5 and 6, I was like, why am I still losing? But yeah, and then I just kind of month 7, I remember the moment and I remember the feeling, but I don't remember exactly what the epiphany was. But I finally was like, oh, now I completely get what I need to do. And I moved straight up to 1530. I'd actually never booked a winning month. But I was like, okay, I get it now.
Wow.
And so I just started playing the 10-20 and the red chip games. And I won that month and won like a bunch of months in a row after that. So
I have never heard a starting out in poker story like that. That's really something.
Yeah, and I think now we probably have a lot of disappointed listeners who would really like to know what that epiphany was.
I think it had something to do with, it definitely had to do with aggression, and it had to do with not just giving up on all hands that weren't top pair. Mm. It had to do with like not folding and instead like continuing betting in like spots that come up over and over and over again. Like you've got, you know, middle pair and like you bet it on the turn instead of just giving up, that kind of thing. Like it was just, I remember being utterly confused by like having pocket queens and then a king flops. Yeah. I think that was like my first 2+2 closed. Was okay, you have pocket queens and like two people limp in and you raise and they call and then a king flops, like what now? I think that was like my very first 2+2 post, and that was like, and I think the epiphany like had to do with like completely working that out.
Yeah.
You know, basically like, well, if you just keep betting they eventually fold and that's pretty much what you want. So
yeah, I mean that is kind of the essence of poker, is like, what do you do when you have neither a great hand nor a terrible hand?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think I was handling those situations in a really just terrible way at first, and then just kind of realized, you know, you can just kind of muddle, you could just, because I would see other people like hang in hands with, you know, with stuff like that, and you know they didn't always lose, and then I started thinking about, well, you don't have to just fold that every time, you know. And I was like, actually, just folding that every time is really terrible because the pot's really big and it's only $8 more. And so I kind of had that, like, that was more or less what the epiphany was. I think it had to do with just like bullying your way through those marginal hands with aggression.
How long before you quit your job at Microsoft?
2 months? 1 month? The timeline actually worked out just, and that's by luck. I had no particular intention. Like, it wasn't like, oh man, I'm good at poker now. See you later, Bill Gates. Like, that wasn't like how it worked. The job at Microsoft was kind of not working out. I got kind of railroaded by politics and sent to this group that was, you know, doomed, that in my opinion was utterly doomed to failure and everyone was going to get fired. And they wouldn't let me out. I wanted to go work on Xbox. I wanted to go work on other stuff. And they said, no, we need you too much. And I said, if you need me too much, then I know this is a failure and you're all going to get fired, you know? And so I was already sort of on the outs there. It just wasn't working out. And then just, it happened that just at that time became good enough at poker to pay for my soup. So
what exactly were you doing at Microsoft? What's your background in that area?
I have a computer science degree, and I was a software developer. And so I worked on their search engine, the MSN search engine, from 12 years ago, which was...
Speaking of doomed projects.
Well, exactly. I mean, it had to do with that. And they were actually, just to tell you what the project was, they were going to build in... So we were merrily working on the search engine, which actually brought in money because people paid advertisements to have their search results come first, because people would click on the search button on Internet Explorer, and that was the cycle. You know,
right.
People clicked on the search button, we got money. And they decided to basically make Siri, like the new iPhone thing where you can talk to it and ask it questions and it gives you answers.
Yeah.
Except we were going to make that for all of Windows. So you could just talk to Windows and say, open that email I sent 3 months ago, you know, to Nate about poker, and like Windows. And this was supposed to be in Vista. And Windows was supposed to figure out, you know, any arbitrary English sentence was supposed to figure out what I meant, open the application, do it. And I was like, are you kidding me? And so, we were starting from scratch, and it was supposed to be done in 18 months. And they told me I was their key player.
An operating system that can't do anything is supposed to figure out natural language processing in
right.
a year.
Well, that we were called the natural user interface is what was the name of our group. And we were exactly. I mean, I was like, you people are absolutely crazy. This is gonna happen. And so, you know, and then, you know, they told me I was bad for morale. I don't know what was up with that. But anyway, yeah. So that was my background. I was a software developer.
Do you ever think about getting back into that? Not trying to do impossible things in Vista, but CS.
Right. You know, at times here and there. I mean, I've just dabbled in little tiny projects here and there. I mean, to be honest, I've thought several times about leaving poker because I've been basically doing this. I just hit my 10-year from quitting my job. So it's been 10 years now that I've been doing nothing but poker. You know, during that time, I'm like, oh, maybe I should, you know, people I went to school with are like, they're splitting atoms and they're launching spaceships and they're, you know, they're doing all these things. And I'm like, you know, I write poker books, which is cool, but you know, it's not a spaceship, you know? And so, yeah, I thought about, oh, well, maybe I'll, you know, hook up with someone who's doing a software company or something. But, you know, poker is, it provides a lifestyle that I really enjoy. And so I haven't been moved on yet, I would say.
So you mentioned seeing people that you knew doing wonderful things. Is it the positive appeal of doing wonderful things that makes you think about that? Or is it something negative about the poker world? Sometimes you hear people say, everybody's so smelly and disgusting, and I don't like to travel if I'm not going to see anything other than a casino, and I'm just done with this. Is it more the positive or the negative stuff that makes you think about these things when you do?
No, it's totally the positive stuff. I mean, I got nothing but good things to say about poker, honestly. I mean, it's been great to me. It's worked out tremendously well, better than I ever could have hoped when I kind of got started with it 10 years ago. And yeah, I mean, there's smelly people and there's this and that, but it's, you know, I don't do a lot of traveling for poker. I mean, I don't do the tournament scene. I don't, you know, it's incredibly flexible for me. I can do it whenever I want, and I have a family, and I can be with my family whenever I want. I can go on vacation, whatever. I mean, I got nothing bad to say about how poker has been for me. So it's more just kind of like, you know, hey, I could maybe launch a spaceship, you know, that would be cool. Like, maybe I should think about doing something like that. But hasn't happened yet. So
you're leading a happy life in poker. You've made a lot of money at poker. You write these great books. Do you have other big goals, or do you just want to keep on doing what you're doing? Is there any like holy grail out there that you're striving for?
Well, that is sort of the question. I mean, I think that's how I ended up in poker in the first place, and not, you know, immediately at NASA, like my people I went to school with, or immediately at, you know, wherever they ended up with. I mean, a lot of people I went to school with had very clear career goals, you know, right out of the gate. I remember the first time, you know, it was like senior year, you know, we'd been drinking beer for 4 years together. And then all of a sudden, you know, people were walking around in suits. And I was like, why are you walking around in suits? And they said, well, you know, I'm going to be an iBanker. And I said, what the heck is an iBanker? Like, this was literally me, you know, in senior year. I mean, I hadn't thought about that. Like what's going to happen after school, like at all. And to some extent, I'm kind of still there. I mean, I think about it, but it's, it's no, I mean, I don't have a clear plan. I wanted to be a novelist. That's something that to me, because I really enjoy the writing process. I like what it means to be a writer and to, you know, write for a living. And so I've thought about writing fiction. It's obviously, as far as supporting yourself writing fiction, it's a little bit boom or bust and
heavy on the bust, I think.
It's very heavy, obviously. Very, or if it were heavy on the boom, I'm pretty sure everyone would be doing it. Right? But yeah, so I would say the number one thing that I sort of like, man, that would be awesome, and that I think actually might happen is I could be a novelist. Stuff. I'm interested in sports analytics and stuff, so I could see going that direction too.
Who do you like to read?
I like reading, just mass market stuff. I like Michael Connelly and mass market thrillers. Not the ones that are like rah rah, you know, America's awesome. Like, not that America isn't awesome, but like not that style so much. The style that are maybe a little darker and a little.
Cool. So if you start writing novels, those will be the kind of novels you're writing some future.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent.
You're saying if, how many unfinished novels do you have saved on your hard
drive? Three. I have three.
Yeah, oh, awesome.
I have three half novels written, and I like my characters, and all of them, I didn't know what to do with the plot after I got halfway through.
Half is pretty far.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most of mine stuff after chapter two.
I've never made it that far.
and maybe I should just glue the two halves together and just, you know, we'll be like, wait, who are these new characters?
Have you done anything in particular? I mean, I do think you're a good writer, not just the content of your poker books, but I mean, I think they're generally, certainly compared to the poker market at large, they're well organized and well explained. Is there anything in particular that you've done to work on your writing skill, or does that just come from reading?
Well, I mean, the big thing that I did actually was I worked, I'll give a big shout out to Al Schoonmaker, who's written a couple of poker books on his own. But when I wrote my first book, which was Small Stakes Hold'em, Mason Malmuth hired Al to edit the book. And so I would write a chapter and I would be like, oh, this is great. And I would send it to Al and he would send it back and it would be just absolutely covered in red. I literally had no idea that my writing was so bad. You know, I think that's how most people are. I mean, I would, you know, write a paper in school and it would come back with two marks on it and a B plus. And that, you know, I was like, hey, I did good. Right. You know, and so I'd never in my life had anybody rip something that I'd written apart literally word by word. I mean, he went word by word and was like, this word does not need to be in there. This word does not need to be there. This word should be a other word. And, you know, and I don't know how many hours he put into it. He must have put a ton. And he kind of did that for the first, you know, half of that book. And then I started to learn because he would write the same things 10 times. You're doing it still, you know. And so he was really instrumental in improving my writing. Just that period, that first half of writing that first book, really, I learned just an enormous amount about how to write.
Are we ever going to see a professional No Limit Hold'em Volume 2?
Unlikely. That was it was contracted with 2+2, and then 2+2 ended up canceling the contract. Right. So
even as, I mean, I know, like, I don't feel like Small Stakes No Limit Hold'em is really much of a follow up to professional No Limit Hold'em, and that it doesn't like pick up on any of the same concepts or anything.
You know, it was kind of like we were, obviously the plan originally was to pick up where professional No Limit Hold'em, you know, started, but then, you know, when the contract got canceled, there was, you know, on our end, there was a little bit of a morale issue. We were like, are we even going to bother doing another book? You know, kind of fell out a little bit with 2+2. And then at some point later, we were like, we are going to do a book, but I kind of had a different vision for the book I wanted to write. So I was like, I want to write this other book.
You and Sklansky wrote a book also, right?
Yes.
So how do you feel is the difference writing collaboratively with other authors versus when you're writing on your own?
Well, it's a big difference. And actually each of the books that I've written kind of collaboratively has been a different process. The book I wrote with David, the No Limit Hold'em Theory in Practice, very funny process. He proposed the book to me, you know, so he approached me and he said, I want to write this No Limit book, but I don't want to write it, basically. So I want you to write it. And I was like, okay, you know, we'll all make billions. So what he did was he had bought like a notebook, like a loose leaf notebook at, you know, the 99 cent store or something. And he had written one sentence at the top of each page. Sometimes you should limp behind limpers with this type of hand, right? Okay. And that was it. That would be all that was on the page. And then he would go to the next page. And then he would say, you know, it is important to sometimes check raise bluff, even if you wouldn't bluff as a bet. Okay. And then he would go on to the next page. And there, and that's what he handed me. He handed me this notebook with these kind of 50 sentences on them. One sentence per page. And he said, this is the book I want to write.
Like Wittgenstein, but no pro style.
I mean, that's what we did. I said, okay, well, this is going to be a book. And he was very, I mean, and so I took that to mean, you know, when he gave me 50 sentences and I was going to turn that into an 80,000 word book or whatever that was, I took that to mean that I would have a lot of say into the other 79,000 words. But it turned out that David had a very, very clear idea of what he wanted the book to be and what was going to be in it and what wasn't going to be in it and what was, you know, that's definitely his book. I mean, I wrote most of the words ended up on the paper from my computer, but I would say kind of like it was very much his created, you know, he had a very firm grasp over what did and did not go into that book.
I think that's why it slipped my mind for a moment that you were a co-author on that. I don't really think of that as one of your books.
Whereas the ones I wrote with Matt Flynn and Sonny Mehta, they were, and those two books, again, those were different also, but those were more collaborative. I mean, those we each wrote bits and then we glued them together.
With Mehta and Flynn, you basically just said, like, chapter X is your responsibility, chapter Y is my responsibility. And I mean, I imagine you gave each other some comments, but more or less you just each did your own thing and put it together.
Well, yeah. It was even more organic than that. It was more like, just write whatever you have to say about poker. Matt was like, these are the things I think are interesting. You know, I wrote some essays about poker, and then Sonny kind of wrote some essays about poker. And then, and on the first book, on Professional Limit Hold'em, I still was primarily a limit player at that time. So even though I'd written this book with David, I still hadn't played that much No Limit. So it was mostly Matt and Sonny's kind of like, this is what we have to say about No Limit Hold'em. And then I kind of glued it together and turned it into a book, I would say. Whereas the Small Stakes No Limit Hold'em was more like, hey, I want to write this book. You know, will you guys write stuff on these topics too?
How did David find you? How did he know that you were a person who would be capable of turning his thoughts into a book?
Well, I'd written Small Stakes Hold'em on my own at that point. Okay. I met Mason Malmuth at a poker social poker function in 2003, and I'd been thinking about writing a book already at that point because. And this was the same year that Moneymaker won the World Series, and I'd been playing full time, I don't know, a year and a half at this point. And already I was kind of getting burned out on playing full time. I was like, you know, when I quit my job and then I played the first, you know, 6 months, like, it was awesome. You know, hey, I'm playing poker for a living. That's pretty cool. I don't, you know, have to go to work. I don't have to answer to anybody. And then by a year and a half, you know, I was grinding, you know, and I was like, I'm not really having fun anymore. And, you know, I got a little burnt out. And I was thinking about, well, I'll just go get a job. And then, but poker was like blowing up all around me at that point. It was, you know, again, Moneymaker just won the World Series. And
yeah, that's a hard time to just walk away from it.
Right. It was, it was exact. I mean, I, you know, and the World Poker Tour TV show, I think it was like the first season that year. And I was like, okay, I have this skill, you know, I can make money playing this game. You know, it's not the most fun thing in the world for me to sit there in the Bellagio card room and play this game 50 hours a week. But, you know, I've got this skill and now it's clearly worth something to me and to other people. You know, why don't I use this skill in another way besides just sitting there for 50 hours a week? Was kind of my thought process at the time. So I was like, well, hey, I'll write a book. I could write a book. I had this idea for a book and I pitched it to Mason, and Mason's like, that's not a good idea for a book. why don't you write a book that competes with Lee Jones's winning No Limit Hold'em book? And I said, you know, that's a good idea. I could write that book. And so that was kind of how that book got started. So I'd written that book, and then David had, you know, worked on it.
Well, I was curious to ask about veganism as well. Am I correct that you're a vegan?
Yes.
What was the impetus for that?
Well, I mean, it's complicated, I guess. I mean, ultimately, I'm a vegan because I don't want to consume animals. So it's definitely an ethical thing first for me. But it started, I don't know, in college. I listened to some bands and they were saying political things that at first I didn't agree with. And then I started to think about more and I started to agree with some more. But the one thing that, you know, and then they were vegan and they, you know, made that known. And I was like, oh, but this vegan thing is, it's kind of weird. I mean, this other stuff that they're on, you know, I'm kind of on board with them on this other stuff, but I mean, what's wrong with eating animals? And then I started to think about it and I was like, well, you know, maybe they're onto something there too. And that was kind of my state of mind for about 5 years. And then in 2002, my mom had a heart attack and I got my, and she survived and she's okay. She's still with us. I, got my heart stuff checked. I was 22, I guess, at the time. I already had heart issues, like cholesterol was through the roof already, blood pressure. My doctor wanted to put me on meds, and I said, I'm 22. I do not want to be on heart meds for the rest of my life. So I said, how can I fix this without doing that? And I did a little research, and I decided I would stop eating meat, and that fixed it. It was 3 months. I told my doctor that. He said, you try it. You come back in 3 months. We'll put you on the meds. I tried it, came back 3 months later, everything was fixed. And he said, I can't believe it. And I said, well, there it is. So I stopped eating meat then. And then I started to kind of learn more about other reasons for not consuming animals. And then I met my wife, and my wife was vegetarian. And we actually got set up on a blind date because we were both vegetarian. So that was kind of how we met. And she had wanted to become a vegan. So we decided that we would become vegans together about 6 years ago. And just during that time, we've become more and more devoted to it. So I'm now very entrenched and thoroughly vegan.
Yeah, my own vegetarianism is overdetermined. I think it sounds like the way your veganism is. And if somebody asks me, I would say that the atrocities of factory farming are like 80% of the reason why I'm a vegetarian. Is it a big part of the reason why you're a vegan, or do the health things kind of come first?
Yeah. I mean, it's, to me, that's the hugest thing by, you know, cause whenever people, you know, oh, I'm a vegan, they say, what does that mean? It says, I don't eat anything that comes from animals. And they say, well, what about spiders? Would you eat a spider? Or like, what about honey? Honey comes from bees. Would you eat honey? Like, why wouldn't you eat honey? Bees are happy, you know? And I'm like, that has nothing to do with it. I mean, it's like, I don't, you know, no, I don't eat honey, but like, that's not the point. Right. The point is, for me, is exactly what you said. I mean, is that literally billions and billions of animals are tortured to become consumable products, mostly food, in this country and around the world. And in many cases, truly and utterly tortured. And the documentation for that is all over the place if you want to go look for it. And, you know, and I just think that's wrong. And so I'm just not OK with that. And that is overwhelmingly the reason why I
call myself a vegetarian, although I'm sure I'm more flexible about that than you guys are. But I've definitely had that same experience of people. There does seem to be this urge that people really want to like point out some hypocrisy on your part. And with me, it's easy to do. I mean, I eat meat several times a year. But if they're like, well, what about this? Would you do this? What about that? Would you do that? And it's never seemed so important to me to be completely absolute about it and say, like, I'm just never going to eat meat. But it seems to me that, like, that's still incrementally better than, like, even if you do eat honey, or even if you do step on spiders, or even if some mice are killed during the farming of your soy, it still seems to me obviously incrementally better than killing more things.
I mean, that's completely my perspective. I'm, you know, I do as much as you're willing, you know, it's like my perspective. Learn about what's going on, you know, learn about how animals are treated in industrial facilities these days. And then once you have that kind of base level of knowledge, you know, you can decide what to do with it. I mean, there are people who literally they're like, I just don't care. And it's like, okay, well, if you just don't care, like you just don't care.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to be able to make you care.
I mean, you've seen the facts, you understand what's going on, and you think that's fine, you know, okay. But I mean, most people don't think it's fine. I mean, most people, you know, we go and show videos to people, and we, my wife and I, she runs a nonprofit here in Vegas called Vegas Veg. We do a lot of social stuff, but one of the things we do is we do some outreach and activism. And so we'll go to UNLV and we'll show this video to college students, you know, and we'll say, what do you think of this? You know, this is the reality. What do you think of this? And most people are like, that's horrible. Once you say that's horrible, it's like, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, any answer that's not nothing is something. And so, yeah, I totally view it as incremental. And yeah, I don't aim for purity there are a lot of vegans that are like, oh, well, I'm more worried to make sure that nothing I consume has ever touched an animal. And to me, that's not the point. To me, the point is I'd much rather, you know, engage people and teach people about what's going on than, you know, make sure that I'm super 100% pure. Or what I mean, to me, that has no value.
Yeah.
The only value is just to get the word out, to get more people understanding what's going on, and to get people to make changes. And some are going to make small changes and some are going to make bigger changes. And I think they're all good.
Is that a hard thing to do in Vegas? It seems like a very meat-centric part of the country.
It's getting easier and easier and easier. I mean, there's constantly things are popping. I think we're almost reaching critical mass. I mean, now you go into just the local pizza joint and they have vegan cheese.
Right.
You know, you go into every month, it seems, I'm learning about a new restaurant has a vegan menu now. There's the famous restaurants and, you know, whoever, Chef Muckety Muck. I don't even know their names because I don't frequent their establishments. But, you know, if you want to eat vegan in Las Vegas, it's super easy.
In any place with plenty of Asian groceries is going to be very friendly to vegetarians,
sure,
and vegans. It's,
yep. I mean,
it's Asia's the best thing that happened to people like us, I think. So
right. Yeah. No, it's totally true. I mean, the Wynn, every place at the Wynn has a vegan menu. Steve Wynn declared it. He said, from this point forward, every restaurant in our establishment shall have a vegan menu.
Is he a vegan?
And so it does. He is. At least he was when he declared that 2 years ago. I never trust, you know, it's always like, oh, here's some famous person, they're a vegan. And then like 6 months later, they're like, not. And it's like, okay, well. So I don't know. I mean, I don't follow him around and watch what he eats. But he did declare that at one point that he was a vegan and that this was going to be the case. They actually have what I call the vegan happy meal at the Wynn, which is you get a little veggie burger and fries and a little chocolate shake, and they have it at like a number of their outlets. But the thing that's amazing about it in this sort of horrible way is that the burger is, they have completely copied that McDonald's hamburger, like the special sauce and the pickle and the onion, like whatever it is.
Wow.
That was on that burger that I remember from when I was 8 years old, when I, you know, ate McDonald's happy meals, like is on that burger at the Wynn. And it's like, wow. Yeah, I mean, I always liked meat. I mean, I'm overweight. I mean, the reason why I had an enormous amount of cholesterol is I had a meat problem. You know, I mean, I ate lots of really bad food, and I ate it because I liked it. And I haven't eaten meat in 10 years, so I don't even really know. It doesn't smell good to me anymore. Like if I walk by a barbecue, you know, it used to be like, oh, barbecue, and now it's like, oh, you know, and that's not something. It just has happened. I don't know why. But I mean, I like the faux meats. I like the, you know, the vegan cheeses, and I like all that stuff. And I try not to eat too much of it.
We're here with Ed Miller, which is awesome. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
And we are looking at part 4 of his Playing the Player book. This part has two sections to it, really. The first part deals with essentially improving these skills and learning to recognize exploitable mistakes in your opponents. Ed focuses in particular on trying to find exploitable mistakes among people who seem not to be exploitable. And Ed, you start with, I think, the very good observation that there are not a lot of really elite players in the small stakes, no limit games. Pretty much anyone who's playing at 1-2, 2-5. I mean, to be honest, I'd say almost everyone I've ever played live poker with definitely had exploitable tendencies. So it's really not a matter of these players, as you say, being too good or unexploitable. It's just a matter of you having not yet found what their exploitable tendencies are. So the book goes through a process for practicing doing this, essentially picking someone who seems like a too good player, someone who seems like they're just not making any mistakes. And the book goes through a whole process of how to make this player your target. I mean, you set for yourself the goal of and ideally it's a person you play with regularly so that you'll have multiple opportunities to work on this, and you'll have the opportunity to apply this information once you've put it all together. But you set yourself the goal of saying, I'm going to take this guy apart. You know, I'm going to figure out his game. I'm going to learn his game, and I'm going to figure out what kinds of things I can do to exploit him. Do I have that right so far?
Yeah, that's sounds right to me.
So I think this is really good. I mean, I think this is the point where the book goes from being just about how to exploit particular mistakes, which I mean, they're common mistakes that you describe in the earlier parts of the book, but still, I mean, you may or may not run into people exhibiting them. And I think this final section of the book does set readers up well to make the next step, which is learning how to exploit any mistake that an opponent is making, to use the same process that you've presumably used to come up with particular tactics for exploiting the particular mistakes discussed in this book, and to set readers on the road to step beyond that and do what winning poker is really all about, which is identifying any sort of mistake that any player is making and take advantage of that mistake. So that's the first section of part four. And then the second section, I would say, is kind of a summary of the rest of the book. I mean, it's entitled The Top 10 Plays to Try That You Aren't Using Today. And most of them are plays that are discussed elsewhere in the book. But I think it is a useful I would encourage people to read the whole book, but I think you could probably get a decent amount of the value of the book and definitely a good sense of what the book is about just by reading this final section that does go through and explains in short some specific things that you can add to your game that, according to the title, you probably aren't doing now, and the circumstances under which to use them and the reasons why they work.
Yeah, and that section alone would probably be worth the cost of the book, I think, just for that last part, even though I would recommend reading the whole book. I think that last part is really good.
Yeah, any specific comments on this section of the book, Nate?
Other than that it's awesome and the best part of the book. I thought that the best thing that I read, probably my favorite thing in the book, is figuring out a plan against the player. I think it fixes a really common psychological leak that people have. And if I'm going to psychologize here, people are really interested in figuring out retrospectively what their opponents do, sometimes because they want to feel good about themselves, or they want to feel that their opponents did something wrong, or they want to somehow feel justified in what they did. And people should really take some of that energy and think forward, because oftentimes the exact same scenario is not going to happen again. And even more often, it's not at all obvious, even if you have an accurate read on somebody, how you're going to take the next step and exploit that person. So the example with where you have ace queen on the jack 4-3 king board, I thought was one of the best parts of the book. And I think generally training yourself into combining the things you know about the player to have like specific actionable goals for taking all their money is a good thing to do, and something that's pretty underrepresented in the poker literature these days. So I would encourage readers to emphasize that. That said, I wouldn't mind it if you wrote a whole nother book that just dealt on that just dealt with the processes whereby you could combine all these different bits of information, just because it is in general such a tricky and non-obvious question. It's like, let's say somebody continuation bets way too much, and also they're too positionally sensitive and they undervalue offsuit aces or something. It's like actually coming up with an action plan can be a little bit tricky, but that's a different book.
Yeah, I'll say I also liked this section on targeting a particular player and trying to get inside of his game, because it addresses one of my concerns about the book from earlier on, which is that there wasn't a lot of information about how to recognize when someone was making these mistakes. Like, it seemed like the book was heavy on what to do when you're up against a loose player or when you're up against a tag, and not as much evidence about how to determine that you're up against that sort of player in the first place. So I think it's good. There's a section on here about observation and about gathering data. That I think fills a bit of a hole from earlier in the book about how to identify the mistakes that someone is making in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, I'm glad you guys like the book. First of all, it sounds like you guys generally like it, which I appreciate. My perspective as a poker writer is I'm super pragmatic. I have very little interest in, my goal is literally to take a certain class of person who's going to read my book. I sort of suppose who's likely to read the book. In this case, the book was written with kind of your average 2-5 player in Las Vegas in mind. You know, it's written, there's, I don't know how many, if you go play 2-5 in Las Vegas, you'll see literally 6 of these guys at your table, like every time. and you know, they all get it. You know, Jack 4, not a good hand. They get that. They get, you know, don't stack off. Some guy, you know, raises you $400 on the river. You've got top pair, probably no good. They get that. They get, you know, I mean, and I'm being glib, but like that, I mean, these are really important things, obviously. They've gotten a lot right about poker. I remember you talked about, like, in the previous episode, like, fundamentals. Like, these are kind of the fundamental things about poker. And I didn't mean to disparage that, you know, in the book. But I did want to point out, like, a lot of people get stuck there because they don't have any idea what the next step is. You know, they read the book. They get to the point where they're thinking, oh, this is how you play poker. You know, you fold when you get your top pair raised. You fold Jack 4 from here. You do, you know, you do all these things. Okay, now I'm doing it right. And they don't think beyond that, when in fact the entire game is beyond that. I mean, everything about the game that makes it a game and that makes it something that you could get the better of someone at, that, you know, is all beyond that point. So kind of the goal of the book is sort of to shake that guy and to say, okay, it's awesome that you've gotten to where you're at. You've worked at it. That's great. But now you need to kind of forget all that and take a completely different perspective at the game. And from my perspective, the game is about, it's about information. It's about hiding information, and it's about exploiting the information you get. That's the first part. But more than that, it's about observing these errors and coming up with a strategy to exploit that error. You want to create not only, okay, these guys are terrible, they make errors. I mean, I hear that all the time. They're like, oh, this game was great. And I say, why was it great? And they're like, oh, the guy was playing 7-6 offsuit from under the gun. And I say, okay, you know, well, what do you do about that? And they're like, you know, you just play your game. You know, as if just playing your game, you know, under those conditions means money will just start pouring onto you. And of course it doesn't. Because sure, that's an error, and sure, that person is slowly losing money, but you're not getting more than your share of that money. And if there's someone else at the table who's better than you, maybe they're getting almost all of it, and almost none of it is getting to you, even if this person is, you know, coming in with 7-6 offsuit. To me, it's about, okay, that's not relevant about, okay, they're making errors and money just kind of floats over to you when that happens. It's much more proactive than that. It's like, this guy makes this error in this spot, and I can make that spot appear over and over and over and over and over again if I just try. You know, okay, they fold too much on the turn. Well, why don't I get to a lot of turns with this person and put a lot of money in the pot before the turn and then bet? You know, like, I don't have to wait till I have ace queen to do that. I can do that with anything, you know, assuming that the rest of the situation is going to play ball. And to me, that's the goal of the book, is to get people to kind of change their mindset. So to get back to part 4, you know, the top 10 things you can do. I mean, I think, again, I'm very practical. So I think it's very important that someone come away with a book, you know, and they're like, okay, this is what I'm going to do, right? This week, I'm going to try to do this. And that's how I advocate you do it. You don't try to do it all at one time. You pick one play. I think one of my first plays is probably raising continuation bets. Because that's like brand new to a lot of people. The idea that, you know, people are making continuation bets. And I say, you know, well, why do you think he's making a continuation bet? And they say, well, because he raised preflop. And I said, so you think he would do that almost always? And they say, yes. And I say, so what does that mean about what they have? And they're like, well, a lot of times they've got nothing. And I'm like, so what do you do? And they say, well, I fold. And I said, well, don't. like, don't. Why do you fold there if they have nothing, like, a lot of the time? And they say, oh, you know. And so I really want people to say, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it, Ed. I'm going to just raise that guy next time, you know, and just see how it works out. It's not going to work. You know, I mean, my worst nightmare, right, is that they run bad immediately after they start to do that, and 5 times in a row it blows up in their face, and they're like, this Ed guy doesn't know what he's talking about. But, you know, obviously, you know, it's a play that works as long as you're understanding the ranges that are getting to that point. And so I want, with the 10 plays and just in general, someone to have a concrete plan. I'm going to start doing this. I'm going to start raising continuation bets, and I'm going to see what happens. And I'm going to try to refine that.
Yeah. So you said that you have a heavy emphasis on practicality and sort of immediate results from your book. And this might get into something that at least me, maybe Andrew, also thought was a little bit less useful, which was your way of cutting up the different player types. And this is something we've criticized on previous episodes, and we should let you get a chance to talk about this. Is for me, lag and tag are not actually very useful concepts to bring to the table, and I tend not to think of my opponents that way. But obviously, you do think that that's useful because you organized your book that way. Do you think that I'm making a mistake and that I should replace some of my current sort of conceptual vocabulary for thinking about my opponents with some of these traditional tag lag categories, or was it just the best way to organize your book? Or yeah.
I don't think you're wrong at all. So here's kind of my thoughts about that. I think most people, when they are like, oh, he's a tag, he's a lag, the amount of information, the amount of actionable information for them in those labels is zero, right? Like, okay. You know, if the average poker player says, oh, that guy's a tag, right, they're no further along than they were before they decided. So, okay. So I agree with you about that. Here's what I would say. I would say two things to that. One is, if I were writing the book today, as opposed to, you know, a year ago or whenever I wrote it, I would change it. I would say my view has actually shifted maybe a little bit since I wrote that. I now kind of group people into people who tend to make folding errors and people who tend to make calling errors. And sort of lumped into the calling error is just like the betting error thing, where people are just giving too much action in general. But basically there's people who give up too easily in certain spots. And then there's people who don't give up easily enough in certain spots. And to me, those are the two big error types, because the branch starts early with those guys. Like, when someone makes folding errors, particularly post flop, you know, and so this is most people who play 2-5 in Las Vegas. I would say, you know, 7 out of 9 of my opponents in one of those games are going to tend to make folding errors. And I remember someone asked the question, well, how quickly do you pick up on this? And I would say immediately, before I even see one hand, you know, I'm typing people based on how they look. But then beyond that, if I see somebody fold hands preflop, I'm going to assume that they're going to make folding errors. Now, there's nothing about folding hands preflop that should necessarily go with that. It just happens that almost everybody who plays 2-5 and 5-10 in Las Vegas, who knows that they should be folding more than half their hands before the flop, also tends to fold too much after the flop. And that just, they just go together. And it's not 100%. And I'm willing to be challenged on that if I watch hands and see things develop, but that's going to be my assumption going, you know, from the beginning. And so when you're against folding error people, you want to build pots pre-flop. So I'm never limping against those guys, because you want to build a pot for them to fold in. So you want to c-bet more, both because they're going to fold to c-bets and also because they're going to call them and then fold on the turn. So, you know, to me, that's kind of where the branch is. It's ultimately what is the mistake they're going to make? Is the mistake they're going to make more likely to be a fold when they shouldn't fold, or is the mistake they're going to make more likely to be putting money in the pot when they shouldn't, like as a bet or as a call? And so I would say, if I had to organize the book today, I might organize it along those lines. But my second point about the organization is that I tried to kind of address that. I sort of structured the book in terms of traits. I said, okay, well, these are traits that tight people have, and it's the trait that's important. So I would say, you know, this guy is willing to bet fold on this. I don't remember exactly what my traits were, but let's say one of the traits was, this guy will bet fold top pair on the turn. Okay, that's a trait like that. And to me, that's like a trait that's typical. It's probably in the tag section, because it's typical of that type of player. But it's really a folding error is what it is. And but that error stands on its own. I mean, you could have a lag that bet folds too much on the turn too. But that, so I kind of tried to break it down to the trait level where I said, see if somebody is bet folding too much on the turn, and this is how you take advantage of that. And then I kind of threw it in the tag section. So I think to the extent that I emphasized tags, you know, wear blue and lags wear green, like I don't think that's very useful. In fact, by not very useful, I think that's like 0% useful. But that's sort of my thinking about that issue. So I sort of like 50% agree with you.
Cool. Thanks.
While we're on the questions, we also have one from Mike from New Jersey. He actually sent us a bunch of questions, but this was one that I set aside specifically to ask you about. He says there's a section on bad players, and he's wondering, how do you play against excellent players who don't readily exhibit any of the weaknesses discussed in the book? And I realize kind of the last part four of this book that we just talked about is meant in some way to address that, to say that there aren't really that many excellent players out there, and it's just a matter of studying them more closely to find their leaks. But I think he's actually interested in, because he says such good players may be few and far between at typical live 1-2 or 2-5 games, but at least conceptually I'm interested in how you think we should play against such players. So if you did happen to find yourself against a really elite player, maybe who's sitting in 2-5 while he's waiting for a 10-25 seat to open up or something, do you have any advice on how people ought to approach that situation?
Okay, I just want to reinforce that they're not few and far between. They're zero. Okay. They literally, I've been playing poker for 10 years. Zero is the tally of people in games in that level who play at an elite level. Okay. So, and the reason why, I mean, I feel like it's important to emphasize that, because I don't know how many times people have come up to me and they say, okay, I was playing 1-2 and there were these three really good players at my table. I want to be respectful, but I want to be like, no, there were not three really good players at your table. So it is a matter of exactly. I mean, it totally is a matter of just like understanding the game better, understanding, you know, where their openings are that exist. And I think that's true even quite high up the food chain. I mean, the number of people who are really, really, truly elite at poker are not many at all. And that does not include me. Because I think to be really, really, truly elite at poker, you basically have to do nothing but sit there and play poker and think about poker your entire life, which is not what I do. I write about poker. I have a 3-year-old. I have a wife. I watch baseball games. Like, you know, I mean, the people that I know, you know, personally, who in my opinion have really gotten to that elite level, or at least credibly convinced me that they've gotten to that elite level, they really are almost infuriatingly obsessed with poker, and they do nothing, and all they want to do is talk about poker and hands and talk about lines, and like they're really not very fun people to hang out with in many cases, because they, and this is not always, and those guys burn out. I mean, almost every, you know, even just in the 10 years of poker that I've been, you know, there's been the elite players and then they quit and they go do something else, because I think 10 years of just being obsessed with poker to the level of that you're going to stay elite, elite, elite throughout the 10 years is just, it's just not many people. So I did want to really emphasize that point, 'cause I think that's super important. In general, if you are against someone who, let's say, is your level of understanding poker is such that you cannot distinguish them from elite. Okay. Which I think is saying something different. Right, like wherever you are at poker, this person is in your game, and you're looking at what they're, and you're just not finding anything that they're doing wrong. Well, information hiding. That's the first place you should go. Okay, is you should think, whenever I'm in pots with this person, I need to hide information about what I have. That's your first goal, because what people try to do, most people react to that situation the other way. Okay. So they are constantly trying to figure out where this guy's at. That, you know, constantly, this guy, oh, he's always on me, you know, so I just raised to see where he was at. I wanted to force the issue. I wanted to, you know, whatever. But that's people's thought process is, man, this guy is like, you know, a blank wall to me. I throw things and they always come back and hit me in the face. Like, I don't know what to do with this guy. And so they're constantly trying to get information out of them. And so they're making raises for information, and they're making blocking bets, and they're doing all these probing things to try to get reactions from this guy. And the problem is that guy understands everything. He understands exactly what you're trying to do. And so all you're doing is you're just feeding him almost perfect information about what you have, and then he's reacting to that. So it's completely the wrong strategy. If you encounter somebody that you think is just really tough, you have to play. You have to say, okay, I'm not going to figure out what this guy has. I'm just not. I'm either not at the level where I understand what's going on, or, you know, a lot of people, they play real loose. They have wide ranges. Like, no, you can't say, oh, he's got king, queen. Like, he could have any of literally 400 different hand combinations. Like, you just don't know. His range is just a blob of probabilities. It's not, you know, he's got top pair. Oh, I know it. He's got top pair. Maybe he's got a flush draw. Like, he's not at that level. He's got a blob of probabilities. And you just need to be okay with that. And you need to make sure that your blob of probabilities is equally inscrutable, right? Like, that is your job. Your job is to say, okay, I need to make sure that I'm playing in ways where he is not going to be able to just figure out what I have because my lines are super unbalanced. So, and that's your job. And then if you want to go beyond that, your job is to maybe get into his head and say, okay, well, what does he key off of, right? He's looking for this blocking bet. If I made a block, you know, I would be tempted to make a blocking bet here if I didn't know what I was at, and I would fold. So why don't I do that with the nuts next time? You know, that kind of thing, where you're reversing some of these sort of obvious things on him. If you want to go beyond information hiding, you can dabble into that reversing. But to me, the number one thing is think, how can I just hide from this guy what I have so that he's as equally in the dark as I am? And if you do that, and if you play tight, because a lot of these guys, you know, a lot of guys who do play well, especially, you know, the guys that play well and do play at the 2-5 and 5-10 level, they play a ton of hands. They play more hands than they theoretically should be allowed to, you know, fundamentally. I find this to be true almost universally. To some extent, they're getting away with it because they play better post-flop. And to some extent, they're not getting away with it and they just don't care. or they don't understand that they're not getting away with it. But the bottom line is, if you are playing tighter and your ranges are stronger and you are sort of equally difficult, you know, your ranges are sort of equally mixed to his, then you will win, you know, because your ranges are better. And you know, lo and behold, when you get to showdown, you're going to win more, you know, and he's not going to just be able to just steal pots in obvious spots. And so to me, that is the first thing to do, is how can I make myself hard to read?
May I offer an addendum to that, and you can tell me whether or not you agree on information hiding versus tough players? Mm-hmm. Shut up. Yeah. If you're in a pot with these people, do not talk. Do not try to get clever. Do not try to elicit information by saying clever things to them, especially if you have flown in from out of town for the main events of the World Series of Poker and put up $10,000. You are not doing yourself any favors. No. Part of information hiding is shutting up.
Yeah, that's true even when you're not in the hand. I mean, just saying to them, just letting them know that that's the way you think about them is already giving away. I mean, saying things like, wow, you're really tough to read. I can never figure out where you're at. Like, all that sort of stuff is giving them information about how you're going to approach them and how you're going to play against them. So I would say, even it's not just when you're in the hand, just generally the less you say, the better about when related to poker anyway.
Absolutely. I think that is a super important point. Like, I think people don't understand a lot of sort of recreational and even semi-professional players don't understand how much even just one sentence that they have to say about poker can hurt them. Like I all the time, people will say, you know, they'll use the word equity, you know, they'll be like, oh, I had equity there or whatever. And immediately I can now peg them on a set of plays that they're sort of familiar with and capable of using, and a set of plays that are probably beyond where they're at. And I'm immediately like making an assumption about what level they're at and going to try to exploit that. That's exactly how I operate. I mean, as soon as I get a sense for kind of what general level of poker knowledge someone is at, I just go with it. I just say, okay, I'm going to assume that I'm right and that's what they know and this is what they do and this is what they don't do. And I'm going to start immediately trying to exploit it. And, you know, it backfires occasionally, but usually it doesn't. And you've said too much. You know, you just need to talk about the weather or the Steelers or something that has nothing to do with how to play poker hands.
No, last year I played in a tournament and the guy two seats to my right looked at a showdown and he said, "Ace Queen, that's a parking lot hand." You know, what's that six word ace queen? That's a parking lot. Seven words. And I knew an enormous amount about this person and how he played poker and how he thought about the game. Seven words.
Yep. Yeah. Well, my story is a very slightly off topic, but I was playing, I believe it was a 2-5 game around the WSOP a few years ago. And the guy next to me was on the phone. He called his wife and I could hear the conversation. And I heard him say, "Yeah, I'm up about $1,000. I'm leaving in about 15 minutes." And once he's told his wife that he's up $1,000, he's not going to lose $1,000, you know? So I definitely found an opportunity in those next 15 minutes to run a big bluff on him.
In general, I never go to get racks until I'm already done. Like, my goal is never to let anybody know that I'm about to leave until it's already happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, because absolutely, I definitely can remember important hands that I've played against somebody where the knowledge that this was their last hand was like paramount in the hand and allowed me to get way, 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 way more information than I was ever entitled to get.
So Jason asks, or he says, your book kind of lumps together stakes from 1-2 all the way up until 5-10, but there's actually a tremendous difference between how those games play. And do you have any suggestions for, do you have any thoughts on how you would apply the book's recommendations differently at different stakes?
Poker's poker. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I feel like in playing the player, sort of that's my goal is to kind of break you out of that. This is a 1-2 game. I shouldn't bluff. This is a 5-10 game. These guys are nuts, or whatever your kind of preconceptions are about the game that you're in and sort of the general strategy to take and say, and really I want you to throw that out. And I want you to look at a more granular level and say, what is really going on in this game? What are the strategies on a more granular, like on a, if you drill into the strategy of what your opponent is doing, what are they doing? Like, when are they folding? When are they calling? Because man, I sort of disagree that 1-2 and 5-10 are like way different. I would say there's way more in common with them than there is different. I mean, it's certainly not the case that, I mean, I have to admit, I do not play 1-2 or 1-3 very often anymore, but I have played them in the last year, a couple of times. And, you know, it's not like, oh, I'm in a 1-3 game. It's like completely different. Like it's exactly the same game. My approach to the game is exactly the same. And that's because my approach is, I'm going to look for the mistakes that these guys are making, and then I'm going to formulate a strategy that exploits those errors, and then I'm going to apply that strategy as early and often as humanly possible so that I can create error after error after error. And that's, you know, that's what I do in all types of games. And so, I mean, that's what I would say. I would really say there really isn't much difference on that level between how the games play. That the errors people make fall into two or three buckets, and maybe at 1-2 you have a few more players that fall into one bucket, then at 5-10 you'll have a few more players that fall into another bucket. But, you know, it's kind of the same cluster of errors and it's the same exploits every time.
I would go 95% of the way there with you. The one important difference I would say that you tend to see, and this isn't really tied to stakes exactly, but I think it does. As you move up in stakes, I think you continue to see the same mistakes and the same types of mistakes. Possibly you see them with somewhat less frequency. Like even if there is a guy who's making bad limb calling decisions at 1-2, there are people who make bad limb calling decisions at 5-10. They may make them slightly less severely, like their limb calling range may be slightly less bad than the 1-2 player's limb calling range. But I mean, the way you're going to exploit them is the same. The biggest difference I would suggest that might exist is that you're going to find more competent players as you move up in stakes who are interfering with your ability to take advantage of the really glaring mistakes that the weakest players are making. So when you sit down in a 1-2 game armed with the knowledge that you're that's coming out of, and I guess again I'm really using 1-2 as a proxy for a weaker game, but I mean I do think the strength of the game tends to correlate with the stakes that are being played. I mean, you sit down at a 1-2 game armed with the knowledge that comes out of playing the player, there's a very good chance you're going to be the best player, not only the best player at the table, but the only player at the table who has much understanding of how to do the kinds of things that are in this book. And that means that when there is a player exhibiting a very obvious mistake, you can just blatantly go after him. You can just merrily raise every single one of his limps and believe that no one is going to 3-bet you unless they have a premium hand. And when you get into a more difficult game, which might often be a 5-10 game, there may be three or four people at the table who understand that concept, and they may not know it as well as you do. They may be making other mistakes, but those players are capable of doing some things that'll interfere with your, you know, like if they see you raise some limpers, the guy on the button might recognize what you're up to, and he might 3-bet you light. Mm-hmm. So just maybe I'll ask a follow-up question on Jason's behalf. Do you have any suggestions maybe for how to play when there's a few other players at the table who are capable of recognizing what you're doing and trying to interfere with it?
Sure. Well, I would say you have to back off some. I mean, there are tables where I'm going to, for instance, c-bet 100% of the time. Okay. C-betting 100% of the time is enormously exploitable, and I need to not do that against someone who understands that it's enormously exploitable. So there are going to be times, you know, that guy will flat call you, right? Just a perfect example, you know, say you're in the cutoff, a really tight guy. Say there's one other guy in your game and somehow he's directly on your left. And there's two tight guys limp in and you're going to just do what you normally do, which is raise preflop, bet flop, bet turn, and everyone goes away. And so you raise preflop and you've got, you know, whatever. So first of all, you have to tighten up slightly because this guy's on the button, you know, and he's messing with you. So you can't, you know, maybe not 9-4 suited. You have to get that frequency down. You can't, that frequency can't be 40, 50% anymore. It has to be closer to, you know, sort of that fundamental frequency. Okay. So that's the first change you have to make. So now, you know, you've got Jack 9 suited. Okay. You raise on the cutoff. This guy flats you on the button. And let's say those two guys limp fold, because that's what they do in Las Vegas. They limp and then they fold. So these two guys fold and your head's up with this guy. So no, you're not going to c-bet 100% of the time against this guy. Not at all. You're going to, I mean, I'm going to check to that guy more often than not, probably. He's flat calling me because he thinks my range is super wide. If my range is super wide, even if his range is sort of wide, but he has position on me and he understands that that's going on, I have no right to just plow into him c-betting all the time. So I need to check to him, you know, and he understands that. So that's how the situation is supposed to go. I'm supposed to check, and then a lot of times he's supposed to put a bet in either on the flop or on the turn or, you know, whatever. So the first point is, yeah, you got to back off. Like, whatever it is that you're doing shamelessly, like, you do have to back off. But then the second thing is, like, Tom Dwan is not in my 5-10 game, like, or whatever, right? Like, Phil Galfond is not in my 5-10 game. These are guys, yeah, they have some basic understanding. They understand, oh, he's raising light, let me 3-bet. Like, that's where they're at, but they're not, they don't know what to do. They don't have a balanced 4-bet, 5-bet strategy. I mean, most of the people I play live against do not. They understand light 3-betting, right? But they do not understand 4-bet, 5-bet strategy like you do if you play online, you know, 300,000 hands. So that's the first thing. Or there will be at some point where their plan turns to vapor and they now no longer know what to do, right? So, okay, they know to 3-bet me and then I flat them and then I check the flop and they bet and I call and now a turn card comes and now they just don't know what to do because they have not played the situation very much. They don't understand, you know, they're used to in that situation, you know, being up against like a super strong range. So maybe they just give up, but I don't have that range because I understand that they're going to give up. Right. So that's kind of what I would say is with those guys, it's really, you just have to take it one more level. They're messing with you on the most basic level. Okay. He's raising too much. Let me 3-bet, but they hit a wall. They always hit a wall because these guys are not great players in general.
Yeah,
you know,
there's still holes there.
Yeah, I'm not, and okay, maybe people are listening, they're like, I play 5-10 and I'm the best player in the world. Maybe you are, okay? I mean, if you've never played with me, it is entirely possible that you exist and that you are the best player in the world, and I am absolutely not intending to disparage you. I'm talking about my experience with people that I've played with is that almost everybody at these levels has some wall at which point, and it's not even necessarily a criticism. It's not like a personal, like, you can't figure out what to do, or that it's just, let me put it this way. I am incredibly, incredibly, incredibly exploitable when I play 2-5 and 5-10 in Las Vegas if you know who I am and I don't know who you are, because you've read my book and you also, and you've listened to this podcast, and you know that I'm going to make certain assumptions about you. I just told you, if you fold pre-flop, I'm going to assume you make folding errors after the flop. I am, because that's what I assume about people. So you could say, Ed Miller, I'm just going to fold some pre-flop, and he's going to think he can barrel me off my hand on the turn and river. So let me, you know, let him barrel off by checking to him, and I'll snap him off. And you know what? You will. I'll get owned like two or three times until I'm like, you keep check raising the river against me. Like, that's really weird. You know, so you will absolutely get me, you know, a few times. So I'm not even like meaning to say, oh, well, you're not capable of playing on that level, or you're not capable of being a better player. It's just winning in a 2-5 game is there's kind of a few rules, you know, that there's a few bread and butter plays that I use over and over and over again. And I use them because they work. And if you know what they are and you know where I'm at and you know why I'm doing what I'm doing, you know, you're going to get me. And that's what I mean. That's what I mean is that people aren't going to expect you to flat the 3-bet and then check and call with air or whatever. You know, they're not going to expect you to do these like super non-standard things that nobody at 5-10 does. As long as you understand what those are, you know, and understand how to get out of line and to do something that nobody does, you know, you can beat those guys.
You know, Andrew, we've been talking about things to do during a hypothetical thinking poker meetup in Vegas. Like, we're all going to register the main events or whatever tournament with satellite winners. We're going to make AeroPress coffee together. Yeah, we're going to drink tea. We're going to buy Nico a beer. I think we should all also follow Ed Miller around town and check raise him on the river a lot.
Yeah, that would pretty much be my nightmare. It's all of a sudden everybody is check raising me on the turn and river, and I'd be, what has happened?
Yeah, how to exploit a tag 101.
Yeah, if you do that, write in podcast@thinkingpoker.net, and we can compile stories of check raising Ed Miller.
So Doofus Brain on Twitter wants to know. Okay. First, he says, thanks, Ed, for your books, especially Playing the Player. They helped me be a consistent, sometimes dominating winner at 1-2. Playing the Player has many examples of bluff here, drag the pot. Can you talk about when not to bluff? I bluff too much.
The biggest bluffing error that I've noticed that people make is they try to bluff into strength. They try to bluff into strong ranges. And either that takes one of two forms. One is that they acknowledge that the person has a strong range and they have an unrealistic expectation of getting somebody off of it, a particular hand. You know, I mean, I remember, like, basically any time that you're bluff raising the flop to try to get someone off an overpair, don't do that. You know, if you're really certain somebody has an overpair, like, do not try to bluff raise the flop, because it will not work. At least it won't work nearly often enough. I had a student give me a hand, and he had total air, and he's like, I'm certain this guy has aces. And then he like bluff shoved the flop, and the guy snapped him, and he's like, what did I do wrong? And I said, I was like, kind of self-explanatory, right? So if you think a guy is like strong, like, just, you know, now's not the time. But the more common error, I think, is when people don't understand how their opponent's range has strengthened. Here's a typical example. Okay, the flop comes queen 9-6. And I bet, and the guy calls. I love these flops because everything hits the flop and nothing hits it hard, right? Everything from ace queen to 6-4 and king queen to 6-5 and 5-4. I mean, everything hits this flop, but it's gut shots, it's middle pair and backdoor this and that, and it's a bunch of junk, so that on the turn I can know, you know, whether they got there or not. You know, if it comes off a deuce, they didn't get there. And so, you know, fire away. Well, if it comes a 10, right, queen, 9-6, 10, they got there. Everything got there. Everything, right? Whatever they called with on the flop, it's there on the turn. And so I'm done, right? I am no longer trying to push this guy off whatever they have. So, and I think most over-bluffing is it's not understanding when an opponent's range is really a lot stronger, either because a certain card came off that makes it stronger, or because they just misinterpreted how strong the call was in the first place, or I think that's it. So I would say the big thing, if you really feel like you bluff too much, and the other thing I would say is really not too many people bluff too much. I mean, if you bluff and get snapped off, like, that's supposed to happen, right? Like, you're supposed to be bluffing. If I bluff half pot or 2/3 pot, you know, the break-even point is, you know, less than 50-50. So that bluff can still be right, even if I'm losing it more than half the time. So just because you're getting snapped off does not mean you bluff too much. And I really, again, it goes to this. I do not encounter very many people that I could literally say you bluff too much. I mean, it's very uncommon. There are some people. It's very uncommon. But I think it is fair to say that some people bluff maybe at an overall frequency that is not too much. But some of the spots they pick, they could maybe not pick those spots. And so that would be what I would say is work on your hand reading, work on really thinking about deal out, you know, deal out flops and turns. Flopzilla, the software package, is really good for this. Or you can just get a deck of cards and start dealing hands out. And the goal is, okay, you bet the flop. This was the flop. You got called. What do they have? Let's enumerate every possible hand that this guy can have. Okay, now the turn card comes this. Has that turn card improved that range? Has it bricked that range? Like, what does that turn card do to that opponent's range strength? And if you really just start doing that over and over and over again and thinking about, you know, what hands is this guy actually going to want to stack off on? What cards is he looking for? What, you know, if you start thinking in those terms, you immediately start seeing, oh, that's a bluff card. Oh, no, he just got there.
And then our last question comes from JoJo. JoJo says, compared to the population of live 2-5 players in Vegas, tourists and grinders combined, let's say I'm 80th percentile in skill. My goal is to become 99th percentile. If I'm grinding 2-5 in Vegas, how important is game selection? Should I be changing tables and or rooms often or aggressively?
Interesting question. It's one I'm not the most qualified to answer because I do not depend on poker for my income. You know, poker, the money that I make from poker is like extra money. So I don't look at poker the same way that I would look at it if it were 100% of my income. So I'm not the perfect person to answer this question, but here's what I would say. I would say, actually, if your goal is to become the 99th percentile 2-5 player in Las Vegas, here's what I would do is I would game select, but I would try to find the guy that I thought was the very best player at 2-5. You know, play 2-5 until I found somebody and I was like, man, that guy is good, or girl, or whoever, you know, obviously. And who is that person? And then I would game select to get in games with that person every time, whenever possible. I would want to play with that person. And then I would do what I described in playing the player, which is I would just furiously take notes on that person. I would just watch everything they do and try to get a sense for frequencies, try to get a sense for strategies. What are they doing? What is their general approach to the game? What are they, you know, what are their pet lines? What are they vulnerable to? You know, how often are they raising preflop on the button? How often are they raising here, there? You know, how often are they c-betting? Like, collect data mercilessly on this person and then go home and devise your counter strategies and say, I'm going to own this guy. Okay. And what are the 5 plays that I need to do to absolutely own this guy? And, you know, it's exactly what you talked about with, like, let's all shadow Ed Miller and make his life miserable. Like, make this guy's life miserable. Like, figure out how to do that and then do it. And, you know, make it so that this guy's like table changing away from you, you know, and if you've gotten to that point, then I think it's fair to say that you've improved and maybe you're not 99th percentile anymore, but you've definitely improved. If you get from the point where you think this guy is like the best player and you like are worried about him to the point where he's like table changing away from you. So to me, if you want to improve, you find the very best player you can find at your level and you just try to pick them apart. You just do everything you can to figure out what they're doing and what you can do to beat them.
Sounds right to me.
Awesome.
any last thoughts on the book?
I think it's a good book. Buy it. I'm proud of it. I'm happy I wrote it. And I hope everyone who's been following along these last few weeks has gotten something out of it. And I thank you guys for doing the book club on it and having me on.
It was our pleasure. I really enjoyed this.
I enjoyed it too. And if somebody wants to buy the book and wants to buy it in the way that you would prefer them to buy it, I imagine that person should go to your website and buy it through there.
Oh yeah. My website is notedpokerauthority.com. You can buy the book at my website or you can also buy it off Amazon. I make less money, but really, you know, it's up to you. It's not about that. So you can get it on Amazon also. One other thing. I know you guys wanted to ask about multi-way pots. I don't know if you want to ask a quick question about multi-way pots.
There's not much discussion of multi-way pots in the book, but they're quite common in live small stakes cash games. Do you have any thoughts on how to apply the concept from the book to multi-way pots or how you approach a table that has a mix of player types?
Sure. Yeah. So you guys pointed out that you kind of characterized it as an oversight that I didn't have that many multi-way pot examples in the book. I would say I maybe 80% agree with that. With that. And the other 20% is, to me, a book about poker is when I've written 50 to 100,000 words and then I ship it. And then maybe I write another 50 to 100,000 words about poker and then that's a book. So it's certainly not that I don't think it's important or that it wasn't worth writing about. It just isn't in this book. And I sort of agree with you that maybe it should have been. And maybe I think the general sort of idea that you should be like super straightforward and ABC in multi-way pots, I think I don't want to say completely wrong. I think that's overstating it, though I have a tendency to overstate things for effect. But it's wrong. Just because the pot is multi-way doesn't all of a sudden mean you need to just try to make hands. And if you don't make hands, just give up. Because that's not the optimal way to play in multi-way pots. That's how the other three or four people are playing when they're in the pot with you. And so there are certainly times when people have made hands and there's nothing you can do. And at that point, yeah, you get out of the way. But in a lot of cases, no, nobody's made a hand they're really proud of. Let's go back to the queen 9-6 flop or jack 8-5. This is like my perfect. I love this flop. Okay, so flop comes. Three people limp in, and I'm on the button, and I've got, you know, ace deuce suited. You know, maybe the blind calls, and then everyone calls. So it's five ways or four ways, and the flop comes jack 8-5 rainbow, and I've got ace deuce, and maybe I've got a backdoor flush draw because I run good like that. Everyone checks to me. Okay. This is a flop I'm going to bet because I'm usually going to win this pot by the river. At least I'm certainly going to win it well more than my 20% share. And I'm going to win it because the people that I play with in Las Vegas make folding errors. So even if four people are in the pot with me, it's very likely that all four of them are going to have some tendency to make a folding error. In other words, they're not going to stack off for $600 or $700 with jack 10 just because the flop came jack 8-5. They're not going to do that, right? So the question is, how often does somebody have a hand that they're already committed to felt at this point? And even though I have four opponents, the answer is like it's a significant minority first. And second, when they do have that, they're often going to be polite and let me know directly on the flop by check raising me. So the downside of running into a set of fives, a set of eights, someone who's got jack eight suited, it's not that high because A, they're uncommon hands, even with four opponents, and B, they'll let me know, you know, they'll give me the courtesy of check raising my flop bet to $200 and then I fold. So I'm going to bet the flop and I'm not expecting to win it immediately. Somebody's going to call me on that flop because as I said before, it hits everything. So somebody's going to have middle pair. Somebody's going to have a straight draw. Somebody's going to have a gut shot. Somebody's going to have jack 10. Somebody's going to have something that they don't want to fold immediately. Often two people or three people. So let's say two people call. I bet, let's say, so it was what, $20? Let's say it's $25 pre-flop, and there's $125 in the pot, whatever. Say I bet $60 on the flop, okay? And I actually don't want to make a huge bet here because I want people to call with their gut shots.
And also to raise with their strong hands. I think when you bet smaller, it's exactly. More likely they're going to raise you with strong hands versus if you bet exactly. Really big, they might be inclined to slow play.
Yes. Yeah, I agree completely with that. So I'm going to bet 60, and my goal is that queen 10 gut shot and overcard calls me, or, you know, all those hands are going to call me. And so I get two calls and that's perfect. And now I know what cards I'm looking for. I'm looking for a deuce, a three, a four, pairing the bottom five. I'm looking for an ace, which pairs me, which is adds a little wrinkle. I'm looking for a king on that flop. And then to some extent, I'm looking to pair the eight and maybe a six. So those are my kind of like cards I'm looking for. That's like half the deck. So we started out, I was one of five people, and now I bet the flop, and most of the time I'm going to get one or two calls, and now I feel like I'm in a situation where I'm going to win this pot close to 50% of the time because one of those cards is going to come, and I'm going to bet 200, and everyone's going to fold because that's what they do. They don't have a hand they're going to play for $600 on this flop. You know, when the turn flops jack 8-5 rainbow, they check called the flop. They check to me on the turn. The turn's a three. I bet $200. They're both going to fold because most of the time, the best hand out there is jack 10, queen jack. That hand folds for $200 in these Las Vegas games because these guys make folding errors and they're overestimating my hand strength when I run that play. I mean, I'm doing it with ace deuce. They should be calling me down with queen jack, but they're not. And so because of that flop texture, right? It makes it very difficult to make a good hand on that flop. And if they don't have a good hand, and that's the first point. And the second point is I know what turn cards hit them and what turn cards don't. If it comes Jack 8-5, I bet and get two calls. The turn's a 9, I'm done. Because they got there, just like I said before. The turn's a 10, I'm done because they got there. Queen 10 got there. Queen 9 got there. Jack 10 got there. Jack 9 got there. All those hands that called me on the flop got there. So forget it. But when it comes to deuce, a 3, I mean, I know what my cards are. So it's the perfect situation because it's unlikely that they have a hand they're willing to felt on the flop. And I also know which turn cards are mine, which ones I get to claim. And that's perfect. That's the perfect situation. So I'm willing to run that play into a ton of people because it works because it, I mean, it's kind of the same for, it's almost the same for five people as it is for three in that particular case. On the other hand, these, you know, if the flop comes Jack 10, you know, 8 with two hearts, like, forget it. You know, I'm not going anywhere near that flop. Heads up, I might not go near that flop. Five ways, you know, I like to plow through when I'm in multi-way pots with people who make folding errors, which is a lot of the time in Las Vegas. I am always on the lookout to bet flop, bet turn, and win what is really quite a very nice pot. And I'm betting solely based on board texture. I'm just looking at which boards are hard to hit and which boards am I going to know which turn cards are mine. And the more that's the case, the more I'm just going to plow ahead and bet with less and less equity. And the less that's true, the more the boards are coordinated, the more the chance that somebody just has a big hand already, which is true on those straight boards, the more I'm going to back off and or require more equity of my own to keep putting any kind of money in the pot. So that's what I would say about multi-way pots is that the same principles apply. I mean, the same thing that you're doing heads up, you're still doing multi-way, just the standards get adjusted a little bit, I would say.
I imagine some people listen to that and they hear you're talking about when you're going to barrel the turn, and they hear that you say I'm going to win the pot a little less than half the time. And I just want to emphasize the bit that's plenty. It may not sound like people may be thinking, well, I'm not even going to win half the time. What am I putting $60 in the pot for? When you're betting 60 into a pot of 120 and you're getting called by two people, you're getting 4-1 on that bet. Right. So winning the pot 40% of the time is plenty.
Plus, you might be able to bluff the river. Plus, all sorts of great things happen.
Yeah. Plus, you could catch an ace. Plus, yeah. You could catch running deuces. And
you might have the best.
Flop jack eight.
You might have the best one.
Yeah, once in a while, ace high wins. Like, I mean, you know, if we're talking about these things, you know, every now and then.
Yeah. So that's my first answer about multi-way pots. And then when it gets mixed, when there's different player types, you know, as you said, I mean, the scenarios start to spiral out of control. But to me, to me, in the moment, it's never that complicated, or it's really rarely that complicated, because usually there's some specific dynamic going on. Like, there's a nitty player, and then someone who likes to take advantage of nitty players raises in the cutoff. Well, that's a situation I feel like I understand pretty well. You know, I understand what the nitty player is going to do. I understand that the person who's trying to take advantage of it is going to have a wide range, and it's going to behave in certain ways. And so as long as I understand that that's the dynamic that goes on, I can, you know, as long as something's predictable, as long as I could call how the hand's going to play out most of the time, I can take advantage of that. That's sort of my fundamental idea. If I can predict it, I can take advantage of it. Many, many times you can kind of say, okay, well, this guy's going to bet because he always bets because he's crazy. And then this guy's going to call, but he can have middle pair and he's just going to fold on the turn. Well, what does that mean I can do? Well, maybe that means I can call now and then raise the turn. Or maybe that means, you know, maybe that means I just raise now and they both fold or whatever. But as long as you kind of understand who all the players are and think through a little bit about what's going on and, you know, what opportunity is there, I think multi-way pots are not more difficult than kind of heads up pots.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks.
last question from Jojo. Any new books coming up?
I am working with one of my students. He wrote a book and I'm editing it. And so I will probably kind of release that under my website. And the book will hopefully have my blessing. So I'm not writing it. I'm just editing it. But so that's one I'm working on. And I also have kind of a book for people who are just getting started thinking seriously about no limit hold'em. That's going to be fewer words and relatively inexpensive, and is a good one. Probably not for the listener of the podcast, but for the listener of the podcast's two friends who want to learn how to play poker. So that's that I may be doing, but I haven't started word one on that. So, but that may be coming. But the main project is a student of mine is writing a book.
Nice. Well, thanks again, Ed. Definitely appreciate you taking the extra time.
Thank you very, very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Definitely. Pleasure was all ours, I'm sure. So have a good night.
Yep, you too.
Thank you.